Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. The water crisis in Flint, Michigan, and the high concentration of cancer-causing chemicals in Louisiana are just a few examples of how environmental toxins disproportionately impact the health and well-being of Black and Brown communities. Today's guest, award-winning medical writer and bioethicist Harriet Washington, argues that higher risks of exposure to environmental toxins is not just harming the physical well-being of communities of color, they're also an important and neglected factor in their intellectual and mental development. In her latest book, A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind, Harriet Washington writes, African Americans and other marginalized Americans of color are affected by chemicals known or strongly suspected to lower intelligence because they are far more likely to live in sacrifice zones, communities assaulted by environmental poisons and hazards. Addressing this chemical Armageddon will go a long way toward eliminating the, quote, racial IQ gap without changing anyone's genetics. There are solutions we can work toward as individuals, communities, and as a nation. Harriet Washington is an award-winning medical writer, bioethicist, scholar, and author of 6 books, including the best-selling and award-winning Medical Apartheid, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. Her latest book is A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind. Hi, Harriet. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. Thank you for having me here.
Well, before we dive in and talk about your book, I just wanted to get your overall take of what is happening. What really strikes you about this moment?
Well, I think there are a lot of very important things about this moment that are a bit different from what we've been seeing through the decades, if not centuries, that African Americans have been protesting their disparate, unjust treatment, including murder in the streets. Unlike a lot of, in fact, unlike most of the earlier protests, this mirrors the civil rights era, in that we're seeing for the first time highly visible numbers of people who are not African Americans, whites in particular, who are serving as allies, also taking to the streets, demanding justice, demanding an end to the murders, demanding an end to this, frankly, this use of police force as an occupying army. So it's no longer African Americans, people of color, and a handful of white allies, but rather large masses of white people who are no longer accepting this treatment as well. That's very important. And to me, it's very important because I don't think that we would have won the civil rights struggles as when we did, at least, or maybe not at all, had we not had invested white allies. That's what we're seeing now. That's the main difference. Frankly and sadly, what's being brought to bear, what's being, protested against is nothing new. People of color, especially African Americans, have known for decades, have known for centuries that we're being treated unfairly and up to and including murder. Murder in broad daylight by people that we pay to keep the peace. So that's what's different. And that's what really strikes me. And that's what I think is very hopeful to me.
What are your thoughts about connecting the movement and the demands that we're hearing to issues around environmental justice?
Surprisingly, I think there are quite a few. If you remember, it seems a very long time ago now, but through much of 2019, we were focused on the fact that it was the commemoration of 400 years since the advent of African Americans to this country. That was eclipsed very quickly by the pandemic, which is a medical emergency. But what I find fascinating is that many of the elements of racial oppression that have fed the murders in the streets, that have fed the disparate, unjust treatment of Black people, treated like criminals as we go about the events of everyday life. A lot of that oppression also contributes to disease states. So For example, one of the things I find fascinating is that environmental racism is actually a medical manifestation of racism. Mm-hmm. It's not race that puts people at different susceptibility for various illnesses, including environmental illness. It's racism. So that same racism that fuels the protests, that fuels the injustice and the murders, is also fueling medical, frankly, murder. It's happening more slowly. It's a slow form of violence. It's not as dramatic as seeing someone murdered on the street, but it has the same effect when you have entire communities who are forced to live in neighborhoods that abut industrial parks, across the street from bus depots, in housing that is imbued with all kinds of heavy metals, industrial poisons, and vermin. That is actually an assault, a slow, insidious assault composed of chemicals and heavy metals rather than someone taking a baton to your head, but it works just as efficiently. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing actually in environmental racism is actually an outgrowth of that exercise of biopower in the service of disparate poisoning for people, for communities of color. And I've been mentioning African-Americans because we are indeed the people who are most visible, not only in the news media, but I think it's really important to point out that there are other groups, notably Native Americans, who are even, Native Americans, I think, are even more profoundly harmed by this onslaught, but it's less visible.
Right. And this is all connected to COVID. I listened to a few of your recent talks, and you said that you are not at all surprised to learn that COVID is disproportionately affecting people of color for a variety of reasons. Air pollution causes the ravaging of the lungs. You also say that African Americans are more exposed to nephrotoxins at home and at work, and nephrotoxicity is toxicity in the kidneys. Now that we're many months into this, Harriet, and sadly, cases are rising all across the country, including in California and in the South, what are your thoughts about where we are with COVID?
Well, you know, you're right. I did say that we were surprised by this, but we should not have been. One doesn't need a degree in epidemiology to remember that many infectious diseases, especially many emerging infectious diseases, have actually disproportionately affected people of color. And that's no great mystery. It's largely because people of color both have more limited access to the healthcare system and good treatment when they fall ill. And they also have profoundly greater exposure to things that create a vulnerability to illness. As you mentioned, kidney disease, heart disease, we know these to be risk factors for coronavirus 19. Also, the pathogens, air pollution causes kidney disease, among other things. And it even things like vitamin D deficiency, which is a factor, are caused by the fact that African Americans and Hispanic Americans are more likely to live in food deserts, which I like to call food swamps, because the lack of nutritious food that causes deficiencies is joined to a prevalence of especially potent forms of alcohol and tobacco. So frankly, as I wrote in Nature, there is not a single known indication for coronavirus, risk factor for coronavirus, that cannot be tied to environmental racism.
Before we dive in and talk more about your book, Harriet, I just wonder, can you tell us how you got involved in this work? You have also talked about the work you did in the 1980s when you worked in a poison control center.
Yes.
And we can talk more about what you learned about lead, but how did you get involved in this work?
Well, the poison control center actually was accidental, but I absolutely loved it. Rochester, New York, where I lived, used to have a wonderful institution called Lifeline. And it was really the brainchild of a pediatrician who still is practicing in Rochester, New York, named Ruth Lawrence. Basically, it was a suicide hotline combined with a mental health information service combined with a poison control center. These were unmet needs she saw in the community. So we had one center doing all these different things. And it was done by volunteers. A lot of the volunteers were medical students or nursing students or pharmacology students, but a lot were also housewives. We had an FBI agent, like a wide variety of people, and the training was really superb. So I was hired. I worked as a volunteer there, and I loved it so much. When an opening came for a manager job, I applied for it and I got it. And so I served as manager of the center, and it was fascinating. The thing I found that I was attracted to it because of the mental health component, but I stayed for the poison center because I found the poison completely entrancing. I learned so much about poisons, and it's interesting how our knowledge of them has evolved and how culturally things have changed. The 1980s, we had a more crude idea of the effect of, say, lead poisoning. We knew that children who were exposed to something like 10 micrograms per deciliter, we considered that the point at which we had to intervene. We often dealt with kids who were in danger of dying from their exposure to lead. And frankly, there wasn't the resource and not always the knowledge to worry that much about kids who had lesser exposures. But after I left the center, as time went on, I continued reading in the field, and I realized that we were beginning to learn that it wasn't only the kids who had these large emergent exposures, but the kids who had been suffering all their life from low-level exposures who are also suffering profound damage that used to go undiagnosed and unacknowledged. Aside from that, I also have to say that I was also fascinated by poisons themselves, which can be really fascinating. I mean, for example, one of the things I point out in the book is that despite all the talk about nature versus nurture, when it comes to deciding what drives intelligence, the reality is that some poisonous exposures will cause not only frank neurological damage, which can, affect the intelligence, but they also cause long-term genetic damage you could transmit to your children. So some poisons cause both. I found it fascinating work, and it really helped as I decided to address this blight of environmental racism and look at some of the consequences that are not as obvious. I mean, the physical harms are profound and very important, but they're often right there in your face. And what I found that what's happening in the background, which is invisible, is sometimes even more insidious. Behavioral problems don't get diagnosed till like 20 years later. Mm. And then they're misdiagnosed. They're not. It's very hard to ascribe an effect that appears after 20 years to an exposure that you had in the womb. Mm.
And you really focus on this, that, environmental racism is something that we've known about for a while, but what we don't talk about are the cognitive costs.
Right, right. And fortunately, there are a slew of experts who have been working on this for decades, and some of them have done some really precise work in it. I was gratified to see. But you're right. David Rowell, an epidemiologist, had said at one point that if thalidomide had caused profound mental degradation, it would still be on the market. What he meant by that is that thalidomide that causes, profound birth defects that are horrible and that you can actually see, that spurs people to action. But when you have something that causes, say, a slightly slower mental acuity that takes years and years to develop into a behavioral problem, it's harder to see. It becomes invisible. And I didn't want it to be invisible any longer. Also, there's also the political aspect of it, which is almost impossible to escape completely. The fact that we have a cadre of people who are intent on pushing their theory that intelligence is genetically mediated and that low intelligence in people of color is a factor of their race, which is not true.
Right. I mean, it's fascinating to read in your book about the origin of IQ tests and its dark and racist history. So let's talk about that. As you write that there's a common perception that IQ is a measurement of intelligence, that people with higher IQ are smart, those with lower IQ are not. That's a simplistic way to put it. But to talk a little bit about this, what is the history behind this?
The history is that these beliefs were held long before anyone had data to back them up. These beliefs were part of a cadre of Victorian scientists called the American School of Ethnology. And they promulgated this nucleus of beliefs about African Americans. They basically were scientists who told the world who African Americans were, and none of it was very flattering. And one of their messages was that African Americans were inherently low in intelligence. And they had no proof for this, but they were operating at a time when it first became fashionable to collect data to support your beliefs. And they did collect data. Problem is the data was rigged, you know, and Stephen Jay Gould does a masterful job in his book, The Mismeasure of Man, of detailing exactly how this happened. However, so these beliefs existed before we had any data, and they persisted even now that we have data that shows they're not true. One of the problems is that the people who espouse the beliefs, often they're scientists. And I talked about that because, you know, it's logical to cede to the authority of scientists. They're experts, right? But these are more than scientists. These were also people with a very strong political agenda. Every one of them tied their belief in inherent racial inferiority of people of color. They tied the belief to social policies. They all, you know, some of them were eugenicists who wanted to see all Black women sterilized. Others like Rich Mine, he wanted to have all Hispanic people barred from immigration to the U.S. So we're not just talking about pure scientists. We're talking about scientists with a heavy political agenda. And some of them, it's almost laughable. I mean, Shockley, who's sort of the patron saint of these hereditarians, I was in high school when he was first promulgating his belief that African Americans were inherently lower in intelligence. But he couldn't define intelligence. Frankly, no one really can. I mean, you ask five researchers, you get five different answers, or you get no answer at all, which is what I got sometimes. So people are talking about this mercurial attribute that nobody can really define, and yet they're sure that it's less likely to be present in people of color than it is in white people. And when I debate them, what we often end up with is their declaration that all the tests, which are rigged, all the tests will show that African-Americans have on average a 15-point lower IQ than whites. And to them, that is proof that it's genetic. And it's also proof that it's something that can't be remedied, which is not logical. It's not, you can remedy genetic disorders. But then that's a point in the book, though, that's such an absurd argument. Because in 1924, the U.S. closed another 15-point gap in IQ simply by adding iodine to salt.
Yeah. This was incredible to read about. Can you, since you brought that up, why don't we talk about that right now? It just really made me, I started reading more and more about iodine because of that part of your book, and it's just fascinating. First off, talk about the significance of iodine and how it impacts intelligence.
Sure. Iodine is basically an endocrine disruptor. Fancy way of saying that when a baby in utero and a newborn baby, they spend 87% of their metabolic budget, of their energy, building a complex brain. The brain that a baby is building is incredibly complex. It's like this very nuanced choreography. You know, every neuron has to be formed at the right time in the right place and moved to the right time. It's so complicated. Anything that interferes with that can end up with either profound or subtle derangement of people's cognitive ability. And if it happens on the day a certain structure is being formed, you have a small exposure, sometimes a tiny exposure, to a poison, you can end up with mental retardation. Now, you need thyroid hormone to build this brain. The thyroid hormone requires iodine. People who lived in areas where there wasn't much iodine in the water were iodine deficient. And when a woman was pregnant and her child, in her fetus or her child, did not have access to enough iodine, then they're going to end up with brain derangement that could be very subtle, but would result in that 15-point IQ gap. So we had people who, because of lack of iodine in their diet, when they're extremely young or even in utero, end up having lower IQs. And we didn't know all that at this point, but we did know that having insufficient iodine caused goiters. So iodine was added to salt, not to remedy IQ, but to cure goiters. But they found out by accident when they did IQ testing for the Army that people, men in that generation who had gotten the iodine, no longer had the average 15-point lower IQs. That gap had been closed by taking iodine. So now we understand that iodine deficiency is the largest cause of mental retardation in the world. But sadly, we haven't used that information. Sadly, it's still the largest cause of mental retardation in the world. A good part of the world doesn't provide enough iodine. Iodized salt, which we take for granted here in this country, is not the norm, even much of Europe. And in Europe, they do put iodine into other things that partly make up to it. But in many countries, people don't have access to it. So, I think we still have yet to learn this lesson about the very important contribution of environment to intelligence. We're so seduced by this hereditarian belief that intelligence is genetic that we are failing to see and do the sometimes simple and cheap things that could, close these IQ gaps. It only costs a few dollars for a ton to add iodine to salt. There's no excuse for everyone not doing it.
Right. And as you point out, 1/3 of the world's population has too little iodine in its diet. And this also, like you said, includes Europe, because iodized salt is still not the norm.
Right. And then in this country, too, the heart healthy. I mean, it's actually a healthy movement to reduce the salt in your diet. But when people do that, they're reducing the iodine in their diet, too. So they, people should be careful to try to replace that iodine. Even if you're not getting it from salt, talk to your doctor and find other ways that you can get it safely.
Mm. It's just so fascinating to learn more about iodine. Going back to the origin of IQ tests, Harriet, as you write, the fundamental question is, what is intelligence and how is it measured? And you put this question to some scientists. They didn't have good answers for you. One scientist actually said, that is a good question.
Yes. And then fell silent. He didn't have an answer. So, I respect him. He didn't have an answer, so he didn't pretend to. Whatever it is, we don't know what it is. But that doesn't stop us from, claiming to know why some people have less of it than others. It's kind of silly. The other problem, of course, is that one cannot, logically, you have to accept that intelligence is different things in different places. In the West and in the United States, if you ask who is an intelligent person, we think of someone who is can use language well, who's literate, can manipulate numbers. These are things that we value in the West. But if you go to different countries, literacy is not that important in some countries. And surviving in these countries, thriving, doing well, being able to, earn enough to care for yourself and your family and have a good life might not be dependent on whether or not you're literate, whether you can read or not. It might have more to do with how good a farmer you are. How good are you at reading the land and understanding the cycles and that kind of knowledge? If you would pick up an American who's got an IQ, a very high IQ, very literate, very good with numbers, and plop him down in certain areas of the country where his survival is dependent on being able to read the landscape, he might not survive. Okay. So intelligence in those countries is something very different. And yet, unfortunately, some scientists who really should know better are intent on placing everybody in the world on that same Procrustean bed of IQ. The things that we think are important, we apply that to people in vastly different parts of the world. And when they don't measure up to our standards, we decide that they have low IQs. I find that completely absurd. I've never quite understood why experts accept these global rankings of IQ. They must know this. And it's something that is done that is completely illogical. And frankly, it's quite insulting. If you look at the global rankings of IQs, you'll find that there are only two countries in Africa with an average IQ higher than 70. An IQ of 70, by most standards, is the dividing line for mental retardation. So what these scientists are saying is that everyone in Africa is mentally retarded, which of course is absurd. Yeah. What's true is that in many parts of Africa, like in many other parts of the global South, whether you're literate, whether you can, you know, use numbers well has absolutely no bearing on how well you do in life.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're joined by Harriet Washington, an award-winning medical writer, bioethicist, and author of many books. Harriet's latest book is A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are joined by Harriet Washington, award-winning medical writer, bioethicist, and author of many books. I hope you can check out Harriet's work. Harriet, I would love to have you on to talk about all of the books you have written. This one, especially Deadly Monopolies, The Shocking Corporate Takeover of Life Itself and the Consequences for Your Health and Our Medical Future, written back in 2011, Infectious Madness, The Surprising Science of How We Can, quote, Catch Mental Illness, written in 2015, Medical Apartheid, another really great book, The Dark History of Medical Experimentation on Black Americans from Colonial Times to the Present. Harriet's latest book is A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind. Again, in this book, Harriet writes that environmental racism gets a lot of attention, but focusing on the cognitive costs do not get the attention they deserve. I just wanted to ask you about how this information around IQ was really used when the 1840 census employed falsified data to promulgate a pro-enslavement message of racial mental inferiority. Census data purported to show that freedom was unhealthy for the minds of African Americans. Can you talk more about that? I think it's such an important connection to make.
I agree. I'm really happy to talk about that. You know, one of the many things I did not learn in my history classes in high school or even college was that around 1840, enslavement was on life support. There were many reasons why, although the South really wanted and, you know, needed its black bodies to maintain its power in Congress, you know, the fact they couldn't vote, of course, but the fact that each slave counted as 3/5 of a man gave it a lot of political power. But there were many slave uprisings. We tend to hear only about the Nat Turner uprising, but they were increasing in frequency, very bloody, and many whites were living in fear of their lives. There are a lot of things happening to make many people in the South rethink enslavement. And those who were, you know, in favor of maintaining it, often use the argument that, you know, the South needs our slaves. We can't let them go. You know, we're dependent on them financially, et cetera, dependent on them politically. But when the 1840 census was conducted, John C. Calhoun, who had been a medical student and who was a rabid proponent of enslavement, he appointed one of his friends who had similar, you know, outlook to conduct the census. And the results of the census were that they had looked at both black and white people, and the black people had been divided into enslaved people and free people. The census showed very clearly that enslaved black people had much better health than free black people. And in particular, free black people were 11 times more likely to be mentally ill than enslaved black people. And so Calhoun and the other pro-slavery, you know, proselytizers all said, we've been trying to tell you, we need enslavement also because black people cannot survive without white people to look after them. This is proof positive. And unfortunately, abolitionists and the people who opposed enslavement did not give a good refutation of this. They did not address it well. It was addressed by a doctor named Jarvis in Boston, and then it was best addressed by the first black man to earn a medical degree, James McCoon Smith. He had just come back from Glasgow, Scotland, which is where he had to go to earn a medical degree because no white schools would admit him in the U.S. He came back and he wrote very eloquent, very detailed stat defenses, looking all the numbers and analyzing them and showing very clearly that not only didn't the numbers support the conclusion, but also a lot of numbers had been falsified. For example, one insane asylum in Massachusetts that was noted as having 133 mentally ill colored people actually had 133 mentally ill white people. So he refuted the census. He went to Congress and gave his refutation, but unfortunately it got no traction. People didn't pay much attention to it. And I saw accounts 25 years later in psychology journals where they accepted the conclusion as if it were true. So enslavement was in one sense saved by the fact that the census had documented the fact that free Black people did not fare as well as enslaved Black people. A fiction, but a really powerful fiction. And it was actually a very sad lesson in that you know, they were able to use a supposedly objective government to support this argument. We're not now talking about slave owners and rabid racists. We're talking about the U.S. government making an argument for slavery. It was very powerful and very important. I think it's a really good a warning, you know, about the uses of data, even in in the hands of supposedly objective, disinterested people.
Right. Today, we're speaking with Harriet Washington, author of A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind. Let's talk about the chemical exposures now, Harriet, because I want to make sure that we have enough time to focus on this.
Sure.
As you write, heavy metals such as lead, mercury, arsenic, and nearly 150,000 untested industrial chemicals, including pesticides, PCBs, phthalates, and so many more, have been shown to depress IQ, stymie intelligence, and distort human behavior. And I think it's really important also to focus on the fact that you say that oftentimes people want to focus on class here, that, right, for example, Flint really was about low-income people and poor people. You say it's important to note that middle-class African-American households with incomes between $50,000 and $60,000 are more exposed to these pollutants than those of poor white households with incomes below $10,000.
Right. Profoundly poor white households have less exposure to environmental toxins. And, you know, I feel like I understand why people cling to a socioeconomic explanation. People want it to be socioeconomic because, quite frankly, it's so much worse to think of this as being purely racial. Mm-hmm. What does it say about a society where people of color are exposed to poisons at a much higher rate than whites? That's a hard thing to admit. That's a hard thing to confront. It feels a bit better to say that it's poverty, because poverty is something that doesn't have that same moral, connotation. But the facts are the facts, and the facts are that it's people of color who are suffering these exposures. We have to confront that. And the failure to confront that only leads to more disaster. It leads to people, for one thing, not recognizing what's happening. Because if you say it's socioeconomic, then people are pursuing socioeconomic solutions when they're not actually going to work. Because we're not talking about poverty in this case. Poverty is a risk factor, certainly, but it's a risk factor that is eclipsed by race. So we have to admit that if we're going to actually craft, you know, answers and solutions that are going to work. We can't have our head in the sand about this.
You write that even middle-class communities of color tend to lack basic services like trash removal, which means that pathogens accumulate. There are breeding grounds for mosquitoes, for example.
Exactly. Robert Bullard, called the grandfather of the environmental justice movement, he did his first studies in Texas. Texas doesn't have zoning laws to protect homeowners so that you can have industries right next to your house that would not be permitted in some other cities. So, but also Texas has a situation where not only Texas, but Houston, a situation, for example, where there's not good municipal service in some parts of the city. I also found that in large swathes of Florida, lots of areas, lots of cities have historically not provided things like basic garbage collection, basic things like getting rid of the old tires that can be breeding grounds for mosquitoes. That's not done in middle-class societies, like not just in poor areas, but in solidly middle-class societies that you would not think would be an appropriate site for environmental poisoning because of the income and education of people there, but they are, because the people there are people of color. They're Black people, they're Hispanic people. And this is a huge problem. More recently, Peter Hotez talks about it too. He talks about the fact that in his classes at the School of Tropical Medicine, he'll show people slides from southern cities showing them these conditions where there's no trash removal, where there aren't basic services. And he said, and you look at it, and you think you're looking at something as a third world, but it's not. It's happening right in our country.
Let's talk about lead. That got a lot of attention when tens of thousands of people in Flint, Michigan were exposed to high concentrations of lead when the city's water source switched Detroit Water Systems to the Flint River. Dr. Mona Atisha, who has worked tirelessly on behalf of people in Flint, especially children, says that 14,000 kids in Flint under the age of six may have been exposed to lead in their water. The percentage of third graders in Flint who passed Michigan's standardized literacy test dropped from 41% to 10%. That is a huge drop. But as you say, this is not just happening in Flint. This is really a U.S. story.
Exactly. You know, I get periodic phone calls from people saying, oh, let's talk about what's happening in Newark. Newark is an epicenter. Let's talk about what's happening in other cities. I'm like, you know, it's not Newark and Baltimore and Flint that have lead poisoning problem. America has a lead poisoning problem. Before this happened in Flint, it was happening in Baltimore. While it happened in Flint, it was also happening in New York City. This is something that happens in American cities. Happens in rural areas too, but not with the same press attention. So I actually had worked as a consultant with several law firms in Baltimore who were trying to get compensation for victims of lead poisoning there, almost all of whom were African American. And so I've been doing that for 10 years now. So this is a longstanding problem in many cities. It doesn't, unfortunately, vary that much from city to city, you know. And it's actually... How can I put this? It's a disaster, frankly, but it's an American disaster. And it's something that we have been slow to recognize as a racial problem, except maybe in Baltimore, where it was so profoundly obvious, just couldn't avoid it. But a lot of things have contributed to trap people of color in areas of cities where lead is a problem. And then there's desultory attention from the public health institution that should be helping them.
And for those who are not familiar with what is happening in Baltimore, as you write, nearly two of every five African-American homes in Baltimore are plagued by lead-based paint. Almost all of the 37,500 Baltimore children who suffered lead poisoning between 2003 and 2015 were African-American. So, Harriet, given that you're working with these law firms, the one thing we kept thinking is, what is going to happen to these kids, and what kind of care are they going to receive from cities and states as a result of this lead poisoning?
Well, that's going to vary from area to area, but in general, I think it's safe to say almost nothing. Yeah. Occasionally you'll have a child whose lawsuit is successful. And there have been success stories. I mean, one law firm I worked with told me of a child they'd won a sizable settlement for. And this child who had been told at one point that profoundly mentally retarded, you know, would never be able to, you know, live independently, actually got a lot of treatment and therapy and was graduated from college. No, that's a heartening success story, but that's one child. And you mentioned 37,000. That estimate is definitely an underestimate because the tests that were used to assess lead poisoning in Baltimore turned out to be profoundly flawed. And so there are many children who didn't test positive who indeed were positive. And as far as I know, no corrective was ever undertaken. So, yeah, it's very sad. Most of these children are not going to get the care attention they need. And the thing that I would say, I think I felt a little bit fortunate in that I was really, you know, excited about writing about this. I think it's really important. I really wanted people to know what happened. And I was so excited about it, I didn't feel much anger. But the one thing I do feel anger about is the fact that you know, a lot of these exposures, not only are they unaddressed by public health institutions, but there's a lot of blamed victim, you know, policies and speech being statements being uttered by people whose job it is to protect people, to protect children and adults who are exposed. Instead, they're castigating them, implying that somehow their own fault. And that's something that really has to stop.
You also write that the data shows consistently when lead rates go up, murder rates go up. When lead rates fall, the murder rates fall a generation later.
Yes, and that's the work of several people, including Kevin Drum, who's written about this frequently in Mother Jones magazine. And that's something that has been, you know, validated. I have to say that I think it's important to know this. And, it seems that the correlation seems quite unassailable. When lead exposure has risen due to use of lead in automobiles and lead paint, then we see violence and murder rates go up. When it's banned, we see them fall. That's important. But I'm disappointed that we've felt the need to track murder rates, but we haven't felt the need to track other things, you know, like the intellectual harms done to children, the behavioral problems that arise. There's a lot that is just not being addressed. And I think that it's important to think about the welfare of poisoned people. Looking at murder rates is important, but it also has that savors a bit of the blame the victim mentality. You know, look at the harm these people are doing. That should not be the question. I'm more concerned about the harm that the people who poison them are doing. You know, what's the harm the industry is doing, being allowed to do by our government? It is not, you know, reining them in sufficiently, forcing them to test their chemicals before we're exposed to them. So I think that's where the blame goes. So as you can see, I'm a bit of two minds about this. You know, it's important, but I'd like to see us focus on other things as well.
Right. And it's completely understandable. I mean, as you write, in terms of proving harm, the barrier is so steep because it's demanded by industry. You write it's demanded by scientists whose work is funded by industry. It's demanded by media who, you know, will say, well, there are two sides to this. Let's bring on industry. Is there a direct correlation here? Well, we're not sure yet.
Right. And it's to their economic advantage to never be sure. Mm-hmm. Doubt is not just a scientific principle. It's also a very profitable economic stance. And I have to say that my definition of an industry scientist changed when I wrote Deadly Monopolies. I used to think of them as people who were in the employ of industry, you know, who were funded by them. But now I think of industry scientists as people who take money from industry. And industry gives a lot of money to scientists who it does not fund for very long if they do not come up with results that are amicable to industry's interests, right? So when scientists began clamoring for higher levels of proof, I want to know who these scientists are. You know, not just academic affiliation. I want to know, how much money are you getting from this industry? You know, you're saying that the evidence that lead is causing this particular level of damage is not good enough, that it doesn't rise to the level of proof. Okay, how much money are you getting from the lead industry? That helps me evaluate, you know, what your motivations are. Are they really a seeking of, you know, of the scientific base of health? Or is there something else operating here? The conflict of interest is really prevalent in many of these industry scientists and other scientists who seek to cast doubt on the seemingly clear relationship between exposures and illness.
Harriet, in some cases, these are the same industries that are now saying Black Lives Matter. Inside Climate News has a piece called Chevron's Black Lives Matter tweet prompts a debate about big oil and environmental justice.
Yes. Interesting, isn't it? Mm-hmm. To me, it's very much like evaluating people and their statements. Your statement may contain all the right sentiments. It may be very moving and flowery, but I want to know what you've been doing. Mm. So these industries who are saying the same thing, Do you have any people of color in your employ? Do you have any on your board? What is your record? You know, have you been involved in polluting these areas? What are you doing now within your own industry? So, words are nice, but action behind them means much more. And I think that this tendency to paper over an industry's, a company's bad behavior with, nice words and some kind of token answer to a question that nobody's ever asked you. For example, I'm always amused when they say, we're very sorry what we've done in the past, as if everything's confined to the past. It might not be. And as a result, we're going to make a donation to XYZ, which may have absolutely nothing to do with the fact that you're polluting neighborhoods, It's nice that you're going to put Rosa Parks, posters on buses, but does that really speak to what you're doing? So I think that there's a lot of room for improvement there.
What are some of the other cognitive issues that concern you the most, Harriet? I mean, just one thing, lead. We're talking about slowed growth, anemia, heart disorders, reproductive problems, reduced kidney function, lowered IQ. What else really concerns you?
It all concerns me. And I think the thing that concerns me most is the fact that I don't know if we can. We certainly are not trying to look at the synergy here. Nobody lives only assaulted by lead. The people who are being exposed to lead in their water are also the people who are being exposed to diesel fuels that still have lead in them. They're also the people who are living in neighborhoods that have DDT banned for 40 years, but it's still in the soil. There's also the people whose baby food, Consumer Reports does a fascinating analysis every year, I think, where they look at baby food and tell us how much lead is in baby food. I discovered that for children who are not African-American or Hispanic, baby food is the largest source of lead exposure. So the bottom line is that, to borrow a phrase from David Rosen, we are living in a poisoned world. And there's a synergy going on. We have no idea how lead is interacting with heavy metals like arsenic, PCBs, industrial chemicals of every type, and vermin, pathogens. We have no idea how all these are interacting. And, it's a scary thought, because people who are living under the onslaught of all these things, are we really doing the right thing to focus on one actor? Should there be something else being undertaken? We just don't know. There's too much we don't know. There's a lot of data to be gathered. And frankly, under today's weakened EPA, I don't see it being investigated. I don't see the data being gathered. The other thing I want to point out is that scientists sometimes make the mistake of assuming that there's a threshold when there's not. By that, I mean, they sometimes make the mistake that they believe that there's a certain level of exposure that causes harm, and that below that there isn't harm. But when they do testing to determine that, often the testing is not done on the most vulnerable people. It's not done using fetuses. It's not done on young children. They are the people who are most likely to be profoundly harmed by tiny exposures. And that's a really profound mistake, because very often we're dealing with things, we're having exposures that we're being told are innocuous, not harmful, but they may not be. It might be decades from now when we find out that the quote-unquote innocuous exposure that was below a threshold of harm is actually something that was causing a lot of harm. Two economists, not public health people, economists, did an assessment, and they found that there were thousands of miscarriages. Traumatic abortions that happen as exposure to the lead in Flint's water. All these dead children who were never born. They're invisible because they were never born, and they actually don't figure very prominently in a lot of discussions of the harms. So I think that's, I worry about that. I worry about this blind spot that we seem to have and the effects on fetuses and young children.
Well, Harriet, we would love to have you back for another show to focus on solutions and what we should really be talking about, environmental reparations.
Well, yes, I'm, you know, frankly, that sounds great. I've never gotten to the point where I even thought about reparations because I've been so focused on just clean it up, you know?
Right.
But I'd love to talk about that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but we would love to have you back for a full show to really talk about what it will take to change all of this. So thank you so much for all of your work, Harriet, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rose. I'd love to return.
Great.
Thank you.
We look forward to it. Harriet Washington is an award-winning medical writer, bioethicist, and author of several books. Her latest is A Terrible Thing to Waste, Environmental Racism and Its Assault on the American Mind. You can find out more about Harriet's work at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping our studio going. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll discuss the new Frontline documentary, COVID's Hidden Toll, which examines how the crisis has impacted undocumented farm workers and meatpacking workers who still lack basic protections. Later in the show, we'll get an update on efforts to remove federal agents from Portland, Oregon. Over the past week, federal law enforcement officers have been arresting protesters and driving them to undisclosed buildings and unmarked cars. Join the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. We'll be right back.